Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
Live from Los Angeles, the Win Without Competing Show with Dr. Arlene Barrow, Career Coach 1, and author of Win Without Competing. Now, here's Dr. Arlene.
Thank you, Virgil. I am dedicating today's show to Michael Jackson, singer, dancer, composer, and humanitarian, who won without competing. Propelled by passion, he soared beyond our expectations. He raised the bar higher and higher until he set the standard against which no one can compete, over and over and over. Thank you, Michael, for setting stellar standards. On to today's show. In tough economic times, it is especially important to implement my Right Fit method, which will enable you to win without competing in your career and in your life. I carefully select my guests who serve as powerful users of my Right Fit method. A key component of that method is passion, our career fuel, the impetus and foundation of career success. My guest today, Sherilyn Kenyon, is soaked in passion. But passion is not enough. Sherilyn and my other guests know how to harness their passion. They excel in managing the process and walking down the right fit road to reach their goals. They know how to recognize right fits. They know how to recognize wrong fits. They know whether they can fix or not fix a wrong fit. They know when to walk away. They assume responsibility for their successes and failures. They say to themselves, it's all up to me. Throughout my own career, I have interacted with a wide array of people. As a medical school dean to heading a $60 million education program at the National Institutes of Health, and as the founder and CEO of Barrow Global Search, Inc. I observed that figuring out right fits is extremely difficult for many people to do. As a result, they continue taking the wrong fit road and wonder why they are in wrong marriages, wrong careers, or wrong homes. The solution is simple. Stop asking who is the best or what is the best. Stop comparing and contrasting. If all your choices are wrong and you pick one, which you designate as the best, you made a wrong choice. Picture a barrel of rotten apples. Grab one. What do you have? A rotten apple. To learn more about my Right Fit method, continue listening to today's show, and after the show, visit winwithoutcompeting.com to read excerpts from my book. On to my guest today, Sherilyn Kenyon, the reigning queen of the vampire novel, according to Publishers Weekly. Kenyon is a true phenomenon. A new Dark Hunter book is published every February, August, and November to the eager hands of Kenyon's devoted fans across the globe who call themselves Kenyon Minions. Each Kenyon release heralds a top spot on the New York Times, USA Today, and Publishers Weekly bestseller lists, and stirs a new wave of obsession from Kenyon's clamoring fans. To date, there are over 17 million copies of her books in print in over 30 countries, and her publisher and bookstores constantly struggle to meet demand. There's more to Kenyon. Over the years, and due to what she humorously calls her children's need to eat, Kenyon has worked a variety of jobs: DJ, photographer — her publishing credits include the Washington Post — store clerk, cook, baker, doll maker, painter, camerawoman, secretary, receptionist, freelance journalist, janitor, waitress, teacher, ditch digger, web designer, programmer, and bookseller. Kenyon is married and has three sons. The family lives outside of Nashville, Tennessee, with a menagerie of pets that include dogs, cats, fish, chickens, rabbits, reptiles. Curious about her website? She has more than 100 million hits per year. Yes, I said 100 million hits per year, and more than that. Her fans eagerly await Bad Moon Rising, an electrifying new arc in the Dark Hunter world, which will go on sale August 4th. Welcome, Sherilyn, to Win Without Competing.
Oops, hey, Arlene, are you there?
Yes, I'm here, Sherilyn.
Oh, sorry. Hi, sorry about that. Mute got turned on. Typical chaos in my house.
Now, Sherilyn, maybe we should be exploring the house chaos before we get into our interview. This is sounding very interesting. What's going on with all these animals? What's going on with the three children and the husband, which I was dying to share later in the interview, but I certainly want to know what happened with the delay here.
I had to beat them out, you know how it goes.
Well, what can I say? We'll talk about you as the right fit mother later on during the show. You were born in Columbus, Georgia. Your father abandoned the family when you were 8 years old and then returned when you were a senior in high school. You told me that as a child, you knew you wanted to be a writer as it provided an escape from your abusive childhood. What were you trying to escape from, and how did writing help you?
Well, everybody has grief. My mother used to have a saying, we're all victims, and I guess in a way we are. But, you know, it was, my mother had, she was bipolar, so she was a great mom when she was on her upswing, but, you know, when she was in one of her lower periods, it wasn't a whole lot of fun. And there were kids everywhere all the time, and it was just a lot of chaos. And so I would escape into a world where I could actually control things. You know, day to day I couldn't control anything. So it was the only way I could, all the little vicious curb bullies that were in my school, that was how I got back at them. I'd turn them into characters and throw them off cliffs.
Ah, so instead of throwing your mother off a cliff, you threw the character off a cliff.
Oh, no, I'd never throw my mom off the cliff. I'd need the wallet.
Oh, good point, Sherilyn. Let's go further. While you, given that you brought up your mom, let's explore a bit. You told me prior to the show that she was your worst critic and your best source of support. You never knew, however, how she would respond because she was bipolar. Tell us a little bit more about that and how you interacted with her and do what I refer to as manage the process, which is to take charge of the situation.
Well, my brother was my guinea pig a lot of the times. I laugh about it. It was not always fun and games, obviously. You didn't know, so the safest thing was always to find somebody who would be brave enough to go in and test her mood and go, okay, today will be you. I went in yesterday. I'll go tomorrow, but somebody has to go. I can't take it today. So we just, you know, when she was in a good mood, like I said, she was the best mother in the absolute world, but when she'd have those moments, you're going, okay, let's not tell her about anything today, because no matter how great you thought it was not going to be good enough.
Well, was she medicated or not medicated?
Back then, no, they didn't really medicate for it. My brother actually made a joke later in life when she finally did get medication. He's like, my God, this stuff would have saved our childhood.
Yeah. So, I mean, how old a woman was she when she was diagnosed as bipolar?
She was, I believe, in her early 50s at that point, maybe late 40s. I was gone by then, so.
Unfortunate for you, but what can we say, Sherilyn? You are a master of managing the process. And as the show goes on, we're going to learn more about your secrets for doing this. In kindergarten, you wrote in your Brownie manual that you wanted to be a writer and a mother when you grew up. Tell us about that. What sort of motivated you to want to emulate your mother, given that she was a very difficult woman to interact with?
Well, I always had a weird appreciation. My mother had a really hard life. You know, my oldest sister has cerebral palsy, and we had my uncle's kids that we were helping to raise, and she had us. And, you know, I don't know how she did it. I mean, I really, given just a normal woman who has to work as hard as my mother did and raise, you know, my sister, her cerebral palsy is very severe. And, you know, my dad left. My brother was 18 months old, so she's got an infant. She's got little kids. She's got, you know, a very difficult situation. So even, you know, he was 8 when I left, I understood that she was doing her best. And so I had no issues with her, unlike some of the other members of my family. I admire my mother for what she did and what she had to overcome.
So you didn't blame her is what you're saying. You
no,
empathized
never.
With her. So
yeah.
I think that's terrific. And that was a very healthy response. What evoked your passion about writing at a young age? I know when we were talking prior to the show, you had talked about it was like a natural response. Tell us more about that and tell us about the characters. And how old were you when they started talking to you?
I started channeling them as far back as I can remember. My mother used to say I literally came out of the womb with a story to tell. Before I could actually write words, I was sitting there drawing photographs on, you know, just picture books. And I still have a lot of just tons of spiral-bound notebooks where I would draw in their entire story arcs. So it was just something I've always done, and the characters just were always there. I never came up with another idea. As long as I lived, I have enough material to write for 10 lifetimes.
So are you able to call them up in your head, or they just appear magically?
They're there. You know, we were coming back from Comic-Con. Yes, that is right. It took me a minute. Wait, where was I? Yes. And, you know, it's that down period where we pack the booth, we're headed to the airport, and everybody's talking, I'm just zoned out, and then suddenly I have this great character, Thorn, which is in Bad Moon Rising, and I'm sitting there, I'm just telling everybody everything about it, and they're going, where did that come from? I'm like, I don't know, but Thorn's here, and he's great, and you're going to love him, I hope.
It's amazing. Do you ever have times where you want to call them up, and they don't appear for whatever reason?
I know writers talk about that, but no, I mean, basically, when I want to go visit with them, it's kind of like going over next door and knocking on the door. They usually answer. I can't think of a time when I've tried and they didn't.
Fascinating. At an early age, you had writing triumphs. In the third grade, you won an essay contest. At age 7, you wrote and illustrated your first novel, and at age 14, you made your first professional sale. How did these accomplishments at an early age affect you, or perhaps they didn't affect you?
They really didn't. You know, my family never really focused on achievements. It was just, okay, kid, yeah, I'm busy, go. So I can't think of, if anything, I guess it gave some validity to it, but I've never been the kind of person who rested on my laurels. So it was just kind of neat, but, you know, it was no real big thing really to me.
So you remember it fondly, but it didn't necessarily spur you on, Sherilyn?
Yeah, the characters and the stories are what drive me, not the success.
Fascinating. Later on, we're going to talk about how you set the standard. And I think that's going to be connected to these characters. But first, I wanted to talk about the fact that your right hand is partially paralyzed and you have severe dyslexia. What did you tell yourself at an early age about your physical challenges?
Again, my sister with cerebral palsy, I never thought anything, you know, compared to her, I've got nothing to complain about. I mean, so there's a couple of things I can't do. I do it with my left hand and I move on. I mean, I've never paid attention other than, you know, I want to play in the Hall of the Mountain King one time really well before I die. But, other, you know, and I can't play the piano even though I try. I just don't have the manual dexterity. I can play chopsticks really good. So, you know, I focus on what I can do really well, and I just admire other people who can do it and wish, you know, for one second, wouldn't that be neat? I love to watch my son play the piano because he's brilliant at it.
Well, I know you told me you have a motto. What is your motto?
Over, under, around, or through, there's always a way.
Let's explore that. When something happens that's upsetting to you, how do you generally respond?
I hunker down, put my head down, and plow forward.
So you take charge. You manage the process like a steamroller.
Basically, yeah.
Terrific. I picture you steamrolling down the street here. Fabulous. Your college years were frustrating. Tell us what happened.
No money. A lot of ambition and no money. It was just, you know, it was very hard. I come from an extremely impoverished background, and I had to work three jobs. You know, I started working when I was 14, saving up money for college even then. When I graduated high school, the one thing my mother gave me was a pair of tires for my car so that I could actually get to college. And it was hard. I mean, it just, the frustration was I couldn't, you know, I wish I could have been one of those kids that I went solid, but I'd have to save up the money, take a semester off, then work, and then go back. So it was,
yeah. So it was a constant struggle.
Yeah. You know, and then there were things that I wanted to do, like because of the dyslexia and because of my hand, I couldn't pass the typing test to get into the journalism school, which is what I really wanted to do. And I really wanted to be in the creative writing program, but apparently I didn't write well enough for that, and they wouldn't let me in no matter how many times I tried.
Well, I think it's fascinating because if they look at you today, they probably would have to say they should have used another method to evaluate your performance, wouldn't you say?
Well, I, you know, you got to have a standard, and I did my best, but sometimes you just, you know, it's finding ways around it, and there's always a way. I mean, you know, I did go on to be a journalist, so, you know, don't let anything stop you.
When you were 20, your older brother typed your first book manuscript, Born of Night. He died.
He actually got the typewriter for me.
Oh, he bought the typewriter
too? No, he borrowed it, actually. It was his roommate's, and he brought it to me.
Oh, he brought it
to you. Oh, he couldn't type at all. God love him.
Oh, he didn't type it then.
No.
Oh, you actually typed it.
Yeah, yeah. I spent my entire Christmas break doing that, every spare minute I had.
Okay, so you typed it. Okay, so he gave you the typewriter on which you typed the manuscript,
mm-hmm.
and then he unexpectedly died, and you lost your desire to write.
Yeah.
Why was he so important to your writing capability?
He was important to everything in my world. He was my rock. I mean, you know, it was an insane childhood. It's been an insane life, but he was the one human being that was supposed to always be there for me, and it was hard to lose that. I mean, I had nothing else. You know, I really, my mother could not be there emotionally, so I really felt orphaned when I lost him, and you know, my belief that life is just and everything that I truly believed in, that I'd been raised to believe in, was ripped out in that 3 seconds of them knocking on the door.
Do you think that if he had not nurtured you, that you would be a writer today?
I don't know. I know I would not be who I am. I don't think I would have the compassion that I have if I had not had him. I definitely wouldn't have the husband I have if I hadn't known him. I don't know. I mean, there's a part of me that will always be angry that I've lost him, because it's hard. I mean, it's, you know, 20-something years later, it's still hard. But I'm grateful that I knew him when I did, for the little time that I had him, because I can't imagine not having had him for the times I needed him.
How old was he when he passed away?
He had just was about to turn 30.
Oh, so he was very young.
Yeah.
Was he ill?
No.
Okay.
It was, he ripped quickly. He died under mysterious circumstances. We're not really
sure.
Yeah. So there's it's an ongoing kind of thing.
Okay. So you've never really figured out. Okay.
Exactly what happened. Yeah.
Yeah. Going further, earlier in your career, in your writing career, you wrote 6 novels, won awards, and hit the bestseller list. Then your writing career came to a standstill. You decided to write a historical romance because that's what was selling in the marketplace. The result? Total rejection from the publishers, and you were annihilated.
Yeah.
But that annihilation changed your life. You decided to stop paying attention to what was selling in New York. Instead, you focused on writing for yourself while listening to the characters and not the market reports. You realized that you should compete with yourself and not against others, which is the theme of my book, Win Without Competing. It took an agent to sell your first Dark Hunter book 10 years. Tell us how you felt when your agent called you and said, St. Martin's Press bought Fantasy Lover, formerly known as Saving Grace.
I was stunned. I would have been turning cartwheels, but I just had a baby, so I didn't want to wake him. I was delighted. Yeah, I know. It was one of those fun phone calls where you're like, okay, I'm really excited, but I just got him to sleep.
But did you during the whole 10-year period, because after all, 10 years is a long time.
Yeah.
Wait. A really long time. Did you ever waver in your belief that you would ultimately sell the book?
Absolutely. Sometime minute by minute. Yeah, I mean, you have to. When it keep, you know, you keep trying and you keep getting the door slammed on you, you do have to go, am I wasting my time? My dad likened my writing. He's like, you might as well be buying lottery tickets. You'd have a better shot. At least occasionally you'd win.
Well, but you were consumed with passion. You obviously felt that you had written something unique. How did your agents respond to what you had written?
They varied. I had many, many agents over that period. There were those who wouldn't touch it. There were those who, the last one obviously loved it, thank God. So it was a varying experience.
Why do you think it was controversial?
Anything in publishing is cyclical. And vampires had been really popular with Anne Rice back in the 80s. And the market had crashed in the early 90s. And from that point on, nobody wanted to touch a vampire novel. So it was just a matter of waiting for, in my case, I didn't wait for the market. We had to recreate the market, which is kind of fun now because I'm the only vampire writer not calling them vampires, because at the time I sold them, you couldn't. So mine are demons.
Ah. To date, however, you have had about 20 Dark Hunter books published. On August 4th, your latest, Bad Moon Rising, will be debuting. Why are your Dark Hunter books the right fit the millions of readers around the world?
I think it's because each book is an exploration of the human soul, of our determination to... The characters in the books are very much like me. They have a lot of crap that they have to deal with. You know, their pasts are not pleasant, and yet they keep going. There's this faith that carries them forward in everything that they do, that there is something worth fighting for, that people and humanity are worth it, even though everything in your past tells you that people will betray you, that they're going to be crappy, that it's not worth getting out of the bed. The books at the end of the day are like, no, if you keep trying, the only guarantee you're ever going to have in life is if you quit, it's over. So get up, strap on your boots, and, you know, trudge forward.
It sounds as if your books are motivational. Am I correct? Do they have that component to them through those characters?
I think so, because, you know, I put every character through the ringer. I mean, they're very real. They laugh, they love, they fight, they curse.
Well, that's okay. I mean, that's life.
Yeah, I mean, they get disgusted just like everybody else. So,
given that you've written 20 books, about 20 books in the series, the Dark Hunter series, how has your passion evolved over the years? Would you say it's remained constant? Would you say it's gotten stronger? How would you characterize your commitment to this highly successful series?
Oh, everything I do is intense. My husband jokes about that all the time. He's like, I don't know how you can live with that state of passion. If I didn't have the intensity, I wouldn't do it. So it's always there. Today I only had an hour and a half worth of sleep. I literally took a nap and had to get up and start writing again. So it's weird. I don't understand it. Eventually I'm going to crash.
So now today, how many hours will you have written during the day?
We're working to get the new website up. So I did 60 pages earlier today in pieces. I did, I think, 20 for about an hour and a half I edited. And then I've been working on the website, then going back to the book, then working on the website, working on the book. So I've been working since 5:30 this morning.
Well, you sound pretty lively, so obviously this hard work hasn't killed you off, Cheryl, and I'm
not
glad
yet,
to say.
Not yet, right.
Are you already started on another Dark Hunter book?
Right now, I'm doing three different things right this minute.
Oh, well, let's hear what you're doing.
I'm working on The Chronicles of Nick, which is what I was writing earlier today, and then I've got my edits that came in today for Born of the Night, which is coming out September 29th. Oh, I did remember. And then I'm also plotting another book for next fall. So I'm kind of working on all three of them.
Is it difficult to work on three concurrently?
Not really. It's kind of, I've got three kids, so I'm used to working with three different people all the time.
And a husband, too.
And if you count my husband and my brother, I have five kids, so, and six if you count the kid next door.
Okay. Well, and then, of course, we have all the fans, too, that I guess...
That is true.
...that also contact you. Well, later on in the show, we'll have to hear some interesting fan stories. In your career...
Fans.
Say that again, Cheryl.
Oh, I have the greatest fans. I love my fans.
Yeah. I want to hear about them, but I'd like to talk about how you have set the standard. How has your... how have you used the internet realm to set the standard?
One of the things that I did, and it's really interesting, my girlfriend and I, she always gets on to me when I say that, she's my best friend. We were talking about this. Technology has finally caught up to what I've been trying to do for decades. I mean, I've been online since the 80s, which I'm not that old, but if I were that old, I would have been on in the 80s surfing Gopher Space, but... when we first set up Dark Hunter a decade ago, it was a networking site, essentially like Facebook and MySpace, but we didn't have the technology to do it at that time. The servers and all just cost way too much. What we are actually doing now is it is a true networking to where the fans are going to be able to come in and talk with the characters in the books like they're real people. They'll be able to build the profile pages, which back then we had a template that they would fill out and we'd post it to the server. All that's so antiquated now. So for the last 2.5 years, we've been developing the new website, which is just this huge monstrosity. And that's what we're working on now. That's, you know, we're going to take it to a realm where back in the day, nobody had, I was one of the first people who blogged. And I blog for my characters. I generally don't blog for me. We had character interviews. We'd set it up, you know, with games and stuff like that. We had Flash animations back when nobody knew what Flash was. So we're constantly innovating and trying to make it bigger and better.
Are you the creative force behind the innovation?
Absolutely.
And to what extent do you technically participate? Because I know that was part of one of your jobs in your career, the IT realm.
Right. I'm actually a cold fusion PHP programmer, so I don't have, unfortunately, the time that it takes. Anybody who's done it knows. You're going, oh, yeah, yeah. I do have a team that helps me. I tell them what I want, and you know, we work together to get everything to look the way we need it to. I don't do much of the hardcore programming. And the hardest thing for me, the programming, I never minded handing off too much because I really don't like doing it. The dyslexia makes it really frustrating at times. But what I really had the hardest time handing off was the design aspects, trusting another artist to come in and create the graphics and such, because you always do the, hey, I want it this way. That's not quite the right shade of green. Fix it.
Are you good at giving a so-called blueprint where you tell them clearly what you want?
Usually, but you know, people, communications are what they are, so sometimes you'll go, I want it to do this, and then they think it means something else, and then you go, oh, no, that didn't work. We got to fix it back. Wait a minute.
Always do you keep the same team working with you?
We rotate out. Basically, some of the key players stay the same, but, I mean, people come and go. They get better job offers and things like that, so it's a morphic kind of thing.
Would you say, then, that this new website will be setting a new standard?
I hope so. That's the goal.
So let's probe a little bit further into this. So let's say I was going to your website. And by the way, what is your website address, and when do you think this exciting site will be posted?
If I didn't need to sleep that 2 hours, I didn't get 2 hours, but it'd be done already. It should be by this weekend, we're hoping. I've had Brian's kind of taking off Saturday in case we crash the server, which we generally do anytime we do a massive reorganization. Saturday's our target date, fingers crossed. We have, is it 18 or 19 different domains? The big important ones are dark-hunter.com, and you need to have the dash in there, or you go to a site you probably don't want to go to. And then there's SherilynKenyon.com. And then
so those will be
the
two sites to go to.
Right, and then all the series that are right have their own. It's all one website, but it takes you to different parts so that you can go to, like, if you want to, the League series, it'll take you to the League portion of the site or the Lords of Avalon portion.
So how will this work? I mean, the visitor will be able to talk to different characters from your books?
Now, we have wall comments. If you're familiar with Facebook or MySpace, you'll be able to post. It's essentially, we've had a bulletin board system to where you could talk to the characters. This is more personal. The characters also have their own blogs, and we'll have RSS feeds to where the fans will be able to, if they want to follow the blogs, who they want to follow. And one of the neatest things that I like, though, is it's kind of like mystery blog. You don't know which character is going to blog that day. So you might get a posting from the character Simi, or you might get one from Kazeel or, you know, Nukirian. You never know who you're going to hear from.
And are you going to do all of these postings yourself?
Basically.
Sherilyn, maybe you should just give up sleeping, period. I don't see how you're going to do it. I mean, it's amazing. 3 children, a husband, 3 books in process now, and you're going to be doing this blogging with all these different characters.
Well, we've been doing it, so it's really not that much different. I mean, I post on Facebook and MySpace, so It really won't be any, in terms of time management, it's the same amount of time I'm still spending online. I really, in the scope of a day, I don't spend that much time online, really.
Because you're able to do it very quickly, is what
mm-hmm.
you're saying?
Exactly. And I know going into it what I'm going to post, so it's just making, you know, 30 minutes to an hour a day to go in and do it.
Let's talk about your relationship with your fans. How do you relate with them? How do they follow you? What happens when a new book comes out?
They are fabulous. We're like a family. You know, there's the energy that you get when you come. I don't even call them book signings. They're not book signings. They're events. They're parties. And it's just, it's like a big family get-together. The one thing, my friend Diana, who travels with me, Diana Love, she's another writer, and I couldn't do the tours without her. She's, oof, just lugging the stuff. We do a lot of giveaways and stuff. Lugging that alone would kill me. But they're just, it's like coming home. I mean, I have the greatest fans, truly. They're supportive of each other. They're just beautiful. I mean, they come from all walks of life. They're male, they're female, they're, you know, soldiers, they're teachers, they're physicians and surgeons. It's just, it's an amazing, one of the, when we did the Parthenon, the Ash launch, there was a Hollywood producer who was in the crowd, and he said, I have never seen such a cross-section. Usually when you come to an event like this, it's, you know, young kids or, you know, he's like, but you've got entire families. You touch everybody. And I'm like, it's, thank God, but they're wonderful. It's like a commonality. It's beautiful.
Have you ever thought about turning any of your books into screenplays?
I bow down before a screenplay writer. My whole thing is respect everybody's expertise. My expertise is not in that format. I'm a novelist, so I personally, because my husband's asked me, do you think you could do it? I'd have to study it. I don't know anything about it, and I'm not even going to have that kind of ego to go, yes, I can do it. I don't know how. So in terms of somebody else doing it, sure, if they want to give it a go, but I don't have the time. I have to work on the website.
Oh, now, Sherilyn, you have to select your priorities here. Well, I'm sure there would be many, many screenwriters that would be very excited to turn one of or more of your Dark Hunter books into a screenplay. Who knows? You might even be contacted after this show. Keep me posted.
That would be cool.
Well, I've thrown it out there. Who knows? I want to touch upon your natural inclination to compete with yourself and to raise the bar higher and higher. How do you think that developed? Do you think that was also rooted in childhood?
Yeah, it's just always, I guess because, my family was never, if you cleaned the entire kitchen, you didn't scrub the sink hard enough, you didn't sanitize it and use, I don't know, Clorox in it. It was, you know, whatever you did, I hate to say, it sounds so bad to say it was never good enough, because that sounds like I'm condemning my mother, and I would never do that. But nothing was ever good enough. My dad was a drill sergeant. You can imagine. You know, the 8 years I had my dad, it was, you can harder, go. So just that whatever you do, you can top it. You know, so it was just ingrained in me. I think just the genetics of my two parents merging inside me. I'm never satisfied with any. I won't say I'm never. Man, that sounds bad, too. I'm satisfied, I'm happy, but I know I can do better. And so as long as I can do better, I'm always going to strive to do better.
Well, when you're writing a novel, do you say to yourself, I'm going to do better with this novel? I mean, do you consciously say it, or it's just a natural inclination?
It's natural. And I mean, there's always, in anything you do, there's always, I could have done better. I wish I'd said this. I wish, you know, we all relive everything. That's why I try, once the book is published, I try never to go back and reread them, because I can't change them then. And that's one of the things working on the League books, because these are books that I'm rewriting. That's been one of the great things about it. I can finally go in and things that I knew were wrong, I can fix them. And it's so wonderful.
your personal life. We touched upon it throughout the show, but now we're going to probe further. You're married to attorney Ken Canyon, who is your business manager.
Three jobs to get him through law school.
We
worked hard jobs to get that degree. Oh, my God.
let's hear about how you got him through law school, and I want to go back about how you met. Yeah, let's hear about your pain and suffering to get him through law school.
Yeah, it was miserable. I love him dearly. He worked in a factory. It was just, God, we had no money. I can't stand a ramen noodle. Oh, my God, if I ever have to see another ramen noodle, I will break into hives. I know every recipe. Anybody who ever needs to know how to cook a ramen noodle, I know anything you can do, how you can make that noodle last for a century. Yeah. Ah, God, I hate it. Yeah. By hook or by crook, yeah.
Well, what we really need to know is how you initially met him, and then I want to talk about why or how he matches the blueprint that you have of the right fit husband.
Well, we met at an 8 o'clock class. Because I had to work till 4 a.m., I always took afternoon, evening classes. And it was marriage and family, and he had ROTC in the morning. He was an Army brat like me. So we met in marriage and family, of all bizarre things. And he was military. Well, my dad was a drill sergeant, but I was the big punk princess with the big screaming mohawk. And,
let's probe that further. Describe the mohawk. Tell me about the nails. Let's hear it all, Sherilyn.
Just
you and I, Liz, talking to each other. Let's just let it all out here.
Oh, I had 2-inch long fingernails filed into a point, painted black. And I remember I went to a very conservative school, so they stared at me like, a freaky science experiment. And I remember one day I was in line. My girlfriend was Miss Georgia, so we're standing there, and I'm in this screaming black get up. It's my clothes, so I'm used to it. Kim's always mocked me for it. But anyway, there are these people, these girls in front of us in line, looking back going, I think that she could have done something better. If she has to match her nails to her clothes, she doesn't have to wear black. And Kim was just rolling her eyes at me going, oh, they don't get it. I'm like, well, neither do you, princess, but, it works for us.
So now, what attracted him to you, do you think? Do you think it was the long nails?
It was just me. What he says is, he's sitting at his desk in his military uniform, and I come popping along, and the night we met, I had, I think the hair was spiked. It wasn't up all the way because it took weight. Back in the day, you had to do it with egg whites and sugar, so you had this concoction you had to make from scratch. It was too much work most of the time. And I come trotting in. I've got, my torn leggings with spider web stuff hanging off of me, and he's like, it was just the cutest little thing I ever saw.
So he was immediately attracted. As you got to know each other, how did you decide that you would marry him? Because I know that you told me that you're very different people.
Oh, yeah.
So now let's hear about the common core, and then let's talk about the differences.
He is a man. He is honorable, and he's decent, and he's kind, and he's level-headed, and he is my rock. He, in some ways, is very much like my brother, and he's my best friend. I mean, he makes me laugh when I need to laugh, although sometimes not necessarily. Every now and again, it's like I'm sinking, and you handed me a rock. What are you doing, honey? Get out! We have the same common, we're both Catholic and things like that, so we have commonality, but other than that, we're screamingly different. He listens to country, I still listen to thrash and punk and alternative, and yeah.
Okay, let's explore how things work when you're dealing with business, B because he's your business manager.
I defer to him, especially with numbers, because it's really, going all the way back to college, because of me being dyslexic, I can't take notes or anything. So, yeah, I would sit there, and I'd be trying to take notes, and it's a disaster. And one night he put his hand over mine. He's like, I've got it. Don't worry. So it was a little thing. That is why I love my husband, because, you know, he's always been there to help when I needed it. You know, he really has. When back in the day when I first started writing, let me back up a little bit. After my brother died, I didn't write forever, and I probably never would have had a girlfriend of mine not gotten me back into it. We were, again, dirt poor. I had no money. I'm thinking, what job can I please get that I don't have to take my clothes off? And Diana offered me a job writing for her magazine. She's like, I know you haven't written since your brother died, but really, we'll pay you if you can eat. So I pulled out his typewriter. I'd actually sold mine at that point. And I sat there and started that article, and that article started the characters back again. I mean, they were back like they'd never been gone. And I heard all these voices, and when Ken finally came home a couple hours later, I'm sitting in the middle of the floor, and I've got paper balled up everywhere, which he is OCD military to the degree. He freaked out. Well, my God, what is this? It looks like a paper factory threw up. And I'm like, I'm writing! And he looked at me for a minute. He's like, are you going to do this every day? I don't know. I think so. Okay, you can't make this big a mess. I will have a meltdown. So he took me out that night, and he never, ever has used a charge card. He took me out, and he charged. They had, before computers, there were word processors that you could store onto a disk, and you could edit on the disk, so it's like a very primitive computer. And he bought me that for $400 with a $10 card table, and he put it up in the corner, and that's where I sat and wrote my first six novels.
He set you up ready to roll here.
Absolutely, and I still have that word processor in the event I ever need it again. I'm not sure it would work, but I have it.
Well, it's a nice keepsake, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
You have three children, actually three sons, 9, 13, and 14. Do you think we may have a future writer among them?
Oh, the baby.
The little 9-year-old. Let's hear more about him.
Oh, it's me with an ego. It's the most scary thing, scariest. Hey, I do know how to conjugate. He's gorgeous. He's just always creative. He's got characters and stories, and he's always he won't play by the rules. And I was that way. Why play Monopoly? I'm going to make up my own Monopoly. We'll have fun. And he does the same thing. When my husband just laughs, he's like, oh, my God, I have two of you now. Oh.
But he's enjoying it.
Oh, absolutely.
What strategies do you use to balance your personal and professional life?
It kind of balances itself. But, you know, to me, because I've lost virtually my entire family. I mean, I have my little brother, and that's about all that's left of my family now, unfortunately. I know how quickly people are taken out of your life, so my family comes first. You know, I don't care how crucial the deadline is. I don't care what's going on. If one of my sons comes and needs me, I stop immediately and pull out, and, you know, I make sure that you know, anytime it's a game or whatever, I'm always home on their birthdays. I'm home on holidays. I drove through the night one night coming back because the plane didn't get there, and I rented a car, and I drove all night long with no sleep to make it home because I'm going to be here. My dad never was, so I will be.
So that your priority is very clear. Your first priority is
absolutely.
Your family.
Absolutely.
You have had
with my fans.
Oh, yeah. Now, that's a good point. Let's not forget the fans who are
listening.
Yes, your fans. You have had many obstacles in your professional and personal life, including hospitalization for a good part of your first pregnancy and most of your second.
Yeah.
Yet, you manage the process. Instead of the situation managing you, you take charge. Tell us how you do this and what advice do you have for your for our listeners?
It's, you know, sometimes I was watching, what is the show? I never watch TV. My husband had it on Plain Sight, and I happened in on a scene of it where one of the characters, I don't even know her name, is an alcoholic, and the guy asked her how she was doing, and he told her, he's like, well, some days it's second by second, and you know, when things are hard, that literally is. Some days you hold on second by second, but you have to have faith. I mean, over, under, around, or through. You just, you know, it gets back to if you give up, it's over. That's the only guarantee you're ever going to have is if you don't try, you will fail. But as long as you try, you're doing something. And, you know, that's, you got to try.
So that you never give up.
I don't know how. I'm too Celtic. They had
Terrific.
To build a wall to keep us out. Rome got as north as they could and said, them Celts, put the wall up. Don't come out.
You are obsessed with wearing black. Why? And do you envision nurturing this obsession forever?
I have many reasons for why. The real reason, I truly don't know why. It goes back to the first really big fight I ever remember having with my mother was in kindergarten over a black dress. And, you know, later on in college, people used to ask why I was always wearing black, and I used to tell them I'm in mourning that the world is filled with idiots, which was a joke, obviously. I've tried to wear color. My husband keeps trying. You know, he'll come home with things going, wouldn't this be beautiful on? I'm like, yes, on fire and on your mom, but not on me. I don't feel comfortable. And I don't really know why. I guess because I've always worn, since the time I started buying my own clothes when I was 14, I just gravitate to black, and I don't ever see that changing. It's also easy to coordinate. I mean, I don't have to think about what I wear. Everything matches. I only have to take one pair of shoes when I travel.
So does that mean also your handbag is black, too?
Absolutely. Everything. Everything.
Everything. And the jewelry?
It's easy. Oh, yeah. But the beautiful thing is don't travel with somebody else who wears a lot of black. We learned this in college. There were three of us. We went on a trip to New Orleans, and we get there, and we're like, who's black? Oh, my God. Oh, gee. We still don't even know if we got the right clothes back.
Your husband is preppy. He never wears black. It's a very interesting dichotomy here, I think. He likes colors from what you told me.
Absolutely, yeah. I go into his closet and it blinds me. It's wow.
Tell us about what the inside of your house looks like.
It's not as grisly, I guess. It's actually a dark yellow, with, you know, we've got browns and blacks and burgundy in it too. It's a very goth decorating kind of thing. But the walls themselves, people walking going, I was expecting it to be a black cave. My bedroom actually is, but the rest of the house is pretty, you know.
The walls of your bedroom are black?
Well, yeah. They were burgundy. I can't stand daylight when I sleep, and I sleep odd hours, so I have a cave. I tried to get them to brick up the windows, but they wouldn't let me. Fire codes, darn it.
Your children, are they dressed in black?
One does. I never, ever force my opinions or anything on my kids. What I'm trying to do is to raise them to make their own decisions, to be responsible for their own decisions, to understand, you know, what happens. And I don't force what I do on them. Now, if I'm buying it for them, I'm going to gravitate to black just because that's what I think they'll look good in. But I have my one son who is the kid swathed in black with a hoodie, and then the other two who aren't. They like bright colors. My baby's favorite color is orange, so I try to buy him orange even though,
Orange is the color of sale. If you ever notice, let's say, in a supermarket.
That is true, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a cheery person. He loves bright colors. So, yeah, we're always getting those for him. It's like, okay, boo, here.
My final question. Are your fingernails still long and black?
Not as long as they're a little long now because I haven't had time to file them back, but yeah, they are still black. Only the tips for one reason only. I can go longer without painting them. I have my one little OCD thing that's really weird is when fingernail polish starts to chip, I obsess over it. So what I do is we have the powder that I get done, and they do just the tips like a French manicure.
Yes.
The tip of it is black, and I've been doing that for so long, my husband didn't even realize it wasn't the typical French manicure.
He thinks that the French manicure
is black tip.
Is the black tip instead of white. Oh, this is wonderful.
Oh, yeah, we found that out last summer. They ran out of the black powder. They couldn't get it in. And I came home with white tips, and I was freaking out. Every time I looked at my hands, I look weird. And he's like, why did they paint them white? I'm like, well, they're French. And he's like, that's French? I thought French was what you had done. I went, no. That was my version of the French manicure. This is normal and weird.
He must have loved it, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah, it was great. I love my husband.
Sherilyn, I thoroughly enjoyed our conversation today. You are a win without competing woman, and I really do hope that you come back and join us soon because there's lots more to talk about. Your career is fascinating.
Oh, thank you so much. I really enjoyed it, and I just thank you, Arlene. This is wonderful.
And I do look forward to having this wonderful interview on your new site because we will be sending you the media player, and all your fans can listen to it over and over and over again.
I can hear my web team going, no, nothing else to post. No.
It's good for them. It's
great.
Good for them.
Oh, absolutely. I can't wait. It'll be wonderful. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Upcoming shows. On July 15th, I will interview award-winning investigative journalist Stephen Fried, who is the author of four acclaimed books, The New Rabbi, Bitter Pills, Inside the World of Legal Drugs, Thing of Beauty, The Tragedy of Supermodel Gia, and Husbandry. On July 22nd, Gunnar Johnson, creator of Throne Is, used in the film Batman Forever. On July 29th, Steve Jordan, fitness guru who overcame paralysis and memory loss. I would love to hear from you. Please email me at drbarro, that's Dr. Barrow, at winwithoutcompeting.com or call 310-441-5305. Please remember that I'm based in Los Angeles. To learn more about the Right Fit Method and my book, Win Without Competing, Career Success, The Right Fit Way, visit winwithoutcompeting.com. For information about career coaching, visit drbarrow.com. And for search services, barrowglobal.com. That's barrowglobal.com. Remember this trigger tip. Walk down the right fit road, and you will win without competing. Goodbye for now. This is Dr. Arlene, author, Win Without Competing, Career Coach One, founder and CEO, Barrow Global Search, Inc.